So Warren Roberts, he's a senior manager in the actuarial insurance division of Deloitte Canada. He has spent 7 years, he's been living in Japan for 7 years, and has worked in the life insurance consulting firm in Tokyo. So tonight, he will discuss about the life insurance industry, particularly including the economic, demographic, and cultural industry within Japan. And he will also share his experience and some of the interesting stories working in Tokyo with us tonight. So right now, I'll pass the mic to Mr. Warren Roberts.
So I can start, I guess. So yeah, my name is Warren, and I worked in Tokyo in life insurance consulting for, I think, 2006 to 2012, and I came back. The last job I held was at Deloitte in Tokyo for about 2 years, and then I transferred back to Canada, and I've been working at Deloitte in Toronto for the last, actually it's exactly 2 years today, February 27th. And you know, anyone who knows me knows that I never shut up about my experience in Japan. I just rattle on about it forever, and so, you know, Fianna came and asked me if I'd like to talk about it, and I'm like, well, it's kind of a no-brainer that I could talk about it. But the best stories I save for after I've had a few drinks, so you'll have to catch me afterwards. But that's the really good stories. But anyway, so to start off, I'd like to discuss the very upbeat topic of natural disasters. This is where I'm going to start. So I'd like to begin with a quiz to test your knowledge about Japan, and you know, don't panic, I have a few quizzes, there's no, you know, you won't fail a pass or anything like that, but you know, if you could show with a show of hands, you know, which you think they are, they're all multiple choice. So the first one here is, what was Japan's deadliest natural disaster? And so the options are the 2011 Tohoku earthquake, which is the big one that they had a couple of years ago, with the, you know, the nuclear power disaster. The next one is the 1995 Kobe earthquake, the 1923 Kanto earthquake, or I think that's the 1792 Mount Uzen eruption. So just with a show of hands, who thinks it's A? No one wants to go for A? Okay, who thinks it's B? Kobe earthquake. Who thinks it's C? And who thinks it's D? So the answer actually is C. Actually, most people got that right. I'm impressed. So, so this is the 1923 Kobe, or sorry, Kanto earthquake. This is basically in downtown Tokyo, and this was a 7.9 magnitude, 7.9, just outside of Tokyo Bay. And as you can see, everything is destroyed here. But it's not actually because of the earthquake. This earthquake occurred in the middle of the day while people were cooking. And so, you know, everything in those days was made of wood, so it was just fire that ruined everything. So all of the ruined, you know, landscape that you see there is all because of the fire. And the deaths, I think, 140,000 fatalities, also mostly because of the fire. This picture is actually taken from the Imperial Palace Hotel, and my Deloitte office was just around the corner from that. Obviously, it doesn't look like this anymore, but, you know, they've come a long way since then, so. So this is a picture of the 1964 Niigata earthquake. And this one is, this is an interesting one. If you see, actually the buildings are intact, but you can see that there are people on the side there trying to, I guess, scramble in through the windows to save their cat, or I'm not sure what they're doing, but. The interesting thing about this earthquake was they learned a lot about a phenomenon known as liquefaction, where if you, I guess when you have loose, unconsolidated soil, and there's a lot of moisture, and then you shake it, how would it occur in an earthquake? The liquid actually bursts through the top, it starts coming to the top, and the soil starts acting like liquid. And so what happened is these buildings just sunk. And, you know, they learned a lot about this, because at this time, 1964, they had actually pretty stringent earthquake code for building, but they didn't know as much about, you know, what kind of ground they should be building on. So this was not the most deadly earthquake, but it was an interesting one. And the picture is cool, so. This is a volcano in the southern tip of Japan. It is called Sakurajima. And this is Japan's most active volcano. And it's one of the 10 most active volcanoes in the world. So So I think this one, it erupts maybe a few thousand times a year, actually, small explosions. And you can see here that there's a city here called Kagoshima, just maybe a kilometer and a half away, easily within the fallout zone of this volcano. So this is an interesting one. And recently, it actually erupted maybe 5 kilometers up into the sky. So people have been living with this for centuries. So I guess what I wanted to demonstrate is that, you know, the Japanese society has been living with these disasters for a really, really long time. It's part of their history and part of their culture. So in terms of volcanoes, I think they have 118 active volcanoes, which is more than anywhere else on the planet. It's 10% of all of the active volcanoes. And they have maybe 7 to 8 typhoons a year, although in 2013, I think they had close to 30. In terms of earthquakes, they have, I think, 1/5 of all of the magnitude 5 or greater earthquakes. And then in terms of tsunamis, well, they have the most reported tsunamis also on the planet, so they got the name of the tsunami, that's definitely worth it. And then I think people don't understand as much about this, but there's actually a significant pandemic risk in Japan. Every season, they actually, part of the year is known as flu season, because flus just sweep all the way through Japan, especially in the greater Tokyo region, because of the concentration, they have 36 million people living in an area about twice the size of the GTA, I'd say. And so, you know, these close quarters and causes these flus to just run through really quickly, and everybody gets them. And so, you know, they have plans in place that, you know, in the event that the flu happens to be serious. So you can see volcanoes, typhoons, earthquakes, tsunamis, pandemic. They actually recorded a tornado for the first time last year as well. So they've just got everything. And then they have the mother of all disasters, Godzilla. But even Godzilla is a metaphor, right? This is what this shows, is that it's worked its way into the cultural DNA of Japan. That they've been living with, you know, for hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years, living with these large, looming, uncontrollable, random disasters that has just become part of the cultural fabric. So I just wanted to, you know, give a sense of, you know, what that does to a culture over time, and, you know, what kind of feelings, what kind of culture, what kind of reactions does it elicit? So I just wanted you to think about that a little bit. Which brings me to my next topic, uncertainty avoidance. Now, a number of years ago, I did my MBA, and one of the courses that we studied was cross-cultural communication. And it was something that I was actually really interested in because it was so different from everything else that we studied. And one of the things that we studied was about this guy, Hofstede, Georg Hofstede, or Gerhard, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but. And he did a study of, I guess, cultural values across 40 different countries. And he did this back in 1980, I guess, as a project for IBM. And what he did is he found 4 dimensions upon which cultures vary. And one of those dimensions he named uncertainty avoidance. And that was basically people's tendency to take steps to, you know, reduce uncertainty, to lower their own anxiety, right? This leads me to my next quiz question. Which country has the highest uncertainty avoidance score out of the 40 countries in the original study? So you basically have to guess. The first is Greece. The second is Japan. The third is that Argentina?
Yeah.
And the last is Germany. So who thinks it is A? Greece. So we have 1. Okay. Very ambitious. Sorry, that's the answer. I didn't want to bother going through the rest. I was like, oh, you got it right. Very good. So this is interesting because you couldn't really predict that it would be Greece. I mean, nobody said Greece. I told myself, if no one says Greece, then I'm just going to show the answer, just like that, because it would be more, you know, could be more effective that way. But anyway, so this is the full results of the study. This is what it looks like, the 40 countries. It's a little bit difficult to see, but you can see. So the very first one up there is Greece. That's the highest. They had the highest score, meaning they took the most steps to, you know, to reduce uncertainty. I don't know what that means in terms of their economy and their debt and everything, but maybe in some other aspect of life, I guess. I'm not sure. But, you know, Japan is not that far behind. I think they're number 7 in this study. So they're also quite high. And again, there's been a lot of historical studies showing that Japan has evolved the way it has because of the influence of this long history of disasters that they've had to live through. Right? And just for reference, we can see we in Canada are somewhere in the middle of the pack there. So, not the worst, nothing. If there is a worse investment, I guess. So, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of these examples of uncertainty avoidance that we see in Japanese society. The first one is their earthquake warning system. Japan is supposedly the most earthquake-prepared nation on the planet. And while I was there for my, you know, five and a half years that I was working in Tokyo, I experienced numerous earthquakes, and they have a really, really cool system for early warning. And basically what it is they have these sensors all throughout the country and even, you know, in the seabed around Japan, and as soon as an earthquake occurs, these sensors will detect, you know, roughly what's the size, and then it'll transmit that information. And so the warning depends on the fact that the earthquake itself, because it's a wave, will travel roughly at the speed of sound, whereas this is being transmitted at the speed of light. So you get anywhere from, you know, 10 to 30 seconds warning that, you know, this earthquake is coming, which is not enough to, you know, go hide in your bunker, but it's enough to, you know, not stand under that thing right there, that big glass thing, or get away from a window or something like that. It's just enough time to maybe duck under a table or something like that. And the big earthquake that they actually had in 2011, these people actually, you know, got about 30, 40 seconds warning that this earthquake was coming. And the thing that's interesting about this is these sensors, they transmit it, and then just the way it gets transmitted is it'll show up on TV. If you're watching a TV, it'll just suddenly appear that there's an earthquake coming, and it's this size, and they announce it over the radio, and the worst one is the phone. It's basically sent to everybody's phone. And so, during that time, after the big earthquake, there were a number of aftershocks. We were constantly getting these earthquakes. And I'd be in the office, and everybody's phone at once, we just have this really creepy ring suddenly, like, nah. You know what I mean? And then everyone's freaking out because, you know, is there an earthquake? We don't know how big, and people are checking their phones. So, yeah, anyway, we had enough time to just get under the desk if it was going to be serious. So, another example. Uncertainty avoidance. If anyone has been to Japan, I imagine a number of people have, you'll notice that their train system is amazing. They have train times, you know, and subways even, that come, you know, they have a schedule to the minute, like 3:52 p.m. And they'll arrive on the minute within a margin of maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds. And if they're like 40 seconds late, they'll apologize profusely. And it's really amazing. And, you know, then you come back to Toronto and you have a TVC and you don't know, can I even go to work today? You don't even know, right? And so it's a little deflating. It's obviously something I miss a lot. But another example, cash holdings. This is a good one. In Japan, it's a well-known phenomenon that households don't really invest in anything other than cash. So they save all of their money at the bank, in the bank account, savings account, basically, which pays nothing. Or it's also very common to actually just keep piles of cash in your house or in a safe or something like that, right? It's well-known that there's this adversity, that there's this perception that, you know, investing in the stock market means we're just going to lose. Nobody thinks about what we're going to win, we're just going to lose. So it's another example. Which, you know, I feel about it most of the time, too. So. Baseball, this is a good one. There was a study recently that showed that Japanese professional baseball players bunt twice as often as MLB players. And bunting being, you know, you sacrifice a run, but to a batter to advance a runner, it's considered a safer play. So this was a, you know, an example, even in baseball, that shows this tendency towards uncertainty avoidance. And the last aspect that we see is a very well-developed insurance market in Japan, and so that brings me to my next topic, the Japanese insurance market. So what I wanted to do is just give you an idea of, you know, the relative size and maturity and sophistication of the Japanese insurance market by just, you know, showing some stats and things like that. So this chart is showing the 2012 premium income, I guess globally, and by country, and it includes life and P&C as well. And you can see that the United States is the biggest, and Japan is number two. And when people say, you know, Japan is the second biggest insurance market in the world, they're usually referring to this statistic. They're usually saying, this is the one they look at. But this is a little bit flawed because, you know, it depends on also how many people do you have. You know, if you have a huge country and you have barely any insurance, you still might show up on here, like China at number four. So I dug up a few other statistics to try and, you know, give you, paint a picture of what the insurance industry is like. So this one is insurance penetration, and this shows, I believe it's total premium, life and P&C again, divided by as a percentage of GDP. And here you can see that Japan, I believe, is number six on that. And this one here is insurance density, and this is total premium divided by, or it's per capita, right? And I believe Japan is number four. So Japan is, you know, placing highly on all of these. So, but the best statistic, I think, is the next one. And that brings me to my next quiz. Okay, so the question is, what percentage of Japanese households had life insurance in 2012? That's the question. So the options are 95%, that's 95.
Yep.
85%, 75%, and 65%. So who thinks it's A, 95%? Okay, who thinks B, 85%? Who thinks C, 75? And who thinks D, 1? The answer is B, which most people got again. I'm very impressed. So this is a survey produced by the Life Insurance Association of Japan. It's equivalent to our CLHIA, the life industry body. And the survey basically asks households, you know, you have at least one life insurance product, you know, somewhere in your family. And so you can see actually that it's been over 90% for a long time. It's recently dipped down to about 85%. But they say that this is the highest rate in OECD countries in the world. So I think this one shows pretty well how pervasive life insurance is in Japan and Japanese households. Okay, so the next two slides, what I wanted to show, were Japanese companies, how big they are relative to, you know, Canadian companies. And so this slide shows its company assets, I believe. So we have the top three Japanese companies. We have Japan Post, Nippon Life, and Dai-ichi Life, and then we have the top three Canadian companies. And Japan Post is an interesting one because it was actually part of, as the name implies, it was part of the Japanese postal system. So it was a state-owned entity, and they had a branch that sold, you know, basic term insurance and other products through the Japanese post office. And they also had a bank, actually, that was part of that as well, where you could, you know, save money. They had savings, savings and, you know, small loans. I think they even had credit cards at one point in time. And the Japan Post actually got spun off, I think, in 2005. But the bank is still state-owned. So just from, you know, just from people going to the post office, they built this humongous insurance company. So who knew that, you know, post offices were the superior distribution force in Japan? So here we see by the same thing, but by premium. So you can see that, you know, Japanese companies are quite big. And I could have included another maybe three or four companies that are all the same size, around the same size as Dai-ichi. So it's not just that the market there is big. It's actually, they have a number of big players as well. So now just to talk about the types of products a little bit that they sell in Japan and what they look like. Under Japanese insurance law, they basically classify insurance into three categories. They call them sectors in Japan. And so the first sector, which is referred to as the first sector, covers, you know, traditional life insurance products and annuity products. And in order to sell these products in Japan, by law, you have to be registered as a life insurance company. Then there is the second sector, which is, you know, P&C, more or less. It's fire, it's auto, it's property casualty, these types of products. And to sell these, predictably, you have to be a P&C, you have to be registered as a P&C insurer to sell these products. And then they have a newer sector, which is, I think, came out in the early 90s, maybe, called the third sector. And these are basically medical supplemental products, like sickness-related products and hospitalization-related products, as well as long-term care. And then, you know, the long-term care is going along with, you know, the increasing aging demographic in Japan. These products are starting to become a little more popular. And the medical type products, actually, they have a public health care system not, you know, too different from our own. So these are more, you know, supplemental type coverages. But, you know, still, they're actually very popular. And they can be sold by both life companies and P&C companies. So within the first sector, to give you an idea of what those look like, I have a breakdown of individual insurance and individual annuities, and they cover things. They have some specialized products like whole life cancer and whole life medical, things like that, which include a death benefit portion. But they also have a lot of endowment, a lot of whole life insurance, and then on the annuity side, they have lots of you know, fixed premium, single premium annuities, or just plain Jane annuities, a small portion of VA, of seg funds. And the thing to notice here is, you know, the products are relatively simple. They don't have, you know, and they're geared towards protection and not so much towards, you know, an investment component. And you know, this reflects, again, uncertainty avoidance, right? You know, they're more interested in downside and protecting against risk than they are, you know, against, you know, making money. So I wanted to speak a little bit about the Japanese economy. I think to understand the life insurance industry a little bit better, you need a little bit of a discussion about the economy of Japan. And that brings me to my next quiz. So, what is Japan's biggest export? Do I hear sushi? Is that right? No? Yeah, no, sushi's not on my list. Okay, consumer electronics is the first one. I think I have motor vehicles there. I can barely see it. Yeah? And the next one is... what is that? Baseball players, oh yeah. Baseball players. And the last one, you know, robots. That's an obvious one, right? So who thinks it's A, consumer electronics? Okay. Who thinks it's B, motor vehicles? Who thinks it's C, baseball players? Not even one. How about robots, D? Thank you. Thank you for humoring me. The answer is B, motor vehicles. Again, the crowd gets it right. So. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the Japanese economy, and you'll see where it gets relevant in a bit. Starting from World War II, Japan went through this period of incredible growth, which is known as they call it the Japanese miracle in Japan. It was a post-war, you know, growth and industry boom for them. And, you know, it was similar to other countries we see going through this rapid industrialization where they have this buildup of infrastructure and things like that. In Japan in particular, there was a lot of infrastructure put into place during this period. They had, you know, which is still there today and makes Japan a very efficient country to do business, especially manufacturing business. So the building of highways and building of high-speed rail networks, airports, ports, dams, things like that. A lot of that was put into place during this kind of golden period. So in addition to this, they opened up trade, which had been traditionally closed. Liberalization, I have to use quotes for that because I don't know if they ever fully got there, but in theory, they liberalized trade. And so they improved democracy and, you know, they introduced free elections, which they did not have under the emperor before. And they also had the emergence of these large business conglomerates known as keidetsu, which I think are very interesting, so I wanted to talk a little bit about them. What these conglomerates are basically a group of companies that have, you know, exclusive related relationships to each other. So the inputs of one of the companies would feed into another and make the outputs of another company. And they, you know, so they have cross holdings of shares of each other. So they really, really work together. They don't really work outside of their group. What one company makes, another company uses, you know, and they usually have a bank in the center that controls the finances of all of them, you know, the lending and the borrowing. And the cross shareholdings between them served, you know, a couple of purposes. And one of those was to keep the share price stable. So Japanese share prices for a long period of time really didn't move anywhere because all your buddies held your shares for you and nobody traded anything. And the effect of that, though, which is different from the West, is it allowed the management of these companies to not have to worry about short-term, you know, market metrics. They could focus on long-term planning, which was, you know, in those days a facet of Japanese management, to look ahead 20, 30 years and worry about that planning versus, you know, what was the share price a year from now, something like that. It also prevented hostile takeovers by having your buddies hold your shares for you. An interesting thing, which helped, you know, the Japanese economy grow, is that because they had these exclusive business relationships with each other, it was very difficult for foreign companies to come in and do business. They basically, this forum, these structures basically locked out, you know, foreign competition because it was more important, the relationships, who you did business with was more important than, you know, what price you were selling something for. So in these formative years of the Japanese economy when they were rebuilding after the war, you know, it was these types of structures that helped them build up these Sonys and these Toyotas and these Panasonics that we see now. They all emerged from, you know, from this type of company. I think a number of the big insurance companies that are in Japan are all part of the Keidetsu, not the Japanese Post, because that was a government company, but the Nippon Life and the Daiichi Life and another big one called Tokyo Marine. All of these guys, you can see there's usually an insurance arm as part of one of these groups, and there's usually a bank in the middle. There are some other structures, though, that are, you know, just their own thing. They grew so big, like the auto wing, they grew so big that it became effectively its own keidetsu. And Toyota is a good example of that. They got so big that they just bought everything upstream and downstream from them. You know, they own all of their distribution, they own all of their inputs, they own everything, and now they're their own diagram, basically. Another good one is Sony. Sony is similar to this diagram, except the electronics portion is in the middle and the banking is on the outside. Sony actually has a bank in Japan, and it has a life insurance company, and it has a P&C insurance company. And those financial wings actually account for almost half of Sony's revenue these days. So, you know, it's a massive thing unto itself. Okay, so after those formative years, there came a period of overheated economic activity and inflation that, you know, they call the Japanese bubble. I think this is maybe 1985 to 1991, and what happened here is typical of, you know, these overheated economies. You saw lots of inflation, you saw asset prices, you know, basically skyrocketing, and increased money supply, and so, you know, there was a lot of speculation, a lot of borrowing, all of the usual suspects that precede a crash, right? And what was, you know, exasperated the situation in Japan's case is the Bank of Japan watched all of this happening, and they knew that, okay, well, we should, you know, start taking action. But they did nothing for a while. They didn't try and, you know, raise interest rates. They didn't try and do any of these things. And so, you know, that basically led to a series of crashes and a period of time known as the Lost Decade. So the Lost Decade is basically 1990s. And it was this period where it wasn't really a big crash, but it was a series of small crashes over time where asset prices came back down and there was, you know, a fair amount of government borrowing, and at the same time, interest rates began a long, steady decline. And this is relevant to, you know, insurance companies and whatnot. The government borrowing, I guess, because there was loss of companies going bankrupt, they had to invest more in infrastructure projects, and they hired more into the government. And so you started seeing Japanese debt, the government debt, climbing. And now, today, it's, you know, got one of the highest ratios to GDP in the world, I think for OECD countries. And in that time also, there were a number of failures of banks and insurance companies. Since 1996, I think seven companies failed, seven or eight maybe. Most of those happened around the mid-90s, but there was one that happened in 2008 during that crisis. They were actually our clients. And they're Yamato Life, they were called. And so, you know, they're a good client of ours. We got a lot of business from them. And then just one day, we're like, oh, no, dial tone. There's no dial tone. There's nothing. We just called, and just, where'd they go? Just disappeared. So, but yeah, that was, and so, you know, there are a number of reasons for this. And the declining interest rates is key among them, I think. So I just wanted to talk about that for a little bit. I've got a graph here of the interest rates in Japan since, I think, 1975, around that. I chose five-year Japanese government bond rates, since they were one of the rates with the longest recorded history. Other rates I could have chosen, which would have been longer, but less history, say. But, you know, they all paint the same picture, basically. So if we look at the first bit here, we can see that's kind of the tail end of the post-war growth era. And then they got the oil shocks and things like that in there as well. And then the next little bit here, this kind of low and then steady decline all the way up to a peak in interest rates is the bubble era. And then you've got this next 20 years, basically, which has been a steady, steady decline. And, you know, they have maybe 15, 20 years of rates underneath 2%. So it's been a long time for them. I mean, they've been doing this for a while now. They've been living in this environment. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this low interest rate environment that they've sort of been going through in the last little while. So let me see. So during this period, they've had low declining interest rates as well as declining equity rates. And this, you can imagine, in the life insurance company industry, this is a really, you know, toxic environment. And it's been a long time. It's not been 2 or 3 years. It's been almost 20 years now. And so when it first started, if I go back a little bit, or right here, if we look at that peak, at that point in time, when we see that middle peak right around 1991, at that time, the most popular type of product in Japan included savings elements with really high guaranteed rates in them. These were like, you know, they dominated the market at this time. And then suddenly there's this big crash. And so this caused a lot of problems in the Japanese life insurance industry because, you know, for one, ALM was not, you know, at the forefront of you know, the Japanese insurance company's mind. They were a little bit behind the ball, I think, in terms of ALM. And so at the same time, right, there was corporate governance, things like this were all a little bit weak in terms of these things. And so, you know, they were stuck. I'll show you on the next slide. This led to a problem known as the negative spread problem in Japan, where they had these high guaranteed rates and they had these really low investment returns. And they, you know, this caused a lot of structural change in the Japanese economy, I think, in the insurance market around 1996 especially. So in 1996, they basically had a reserving and regulatory regime overhaul for the life insurance industry. They came up with new rules in the Japanese insurance law. And one of the main ones was the discount rate that they were using. The discount rate, I think, which is based on, it was the 10-year, yeah, the 10-year Japanese government bond rate. They linked the discount rate to that, whereas previously it was an arbitrary rate being set by the Ministry of Finance. Now it was being linked to these 10-year rates. And these 10-year rates, when they first introduced this, the 10-year rates were at about 2.75%, I think, while pricing rates and guarantees were around 6%. So right off the bat, suddenly the reserve just went through the roof for a whole bunch of these companies that sold these, you know, products with these high guaranteed rates. And that discount rate has now dropped since 2013 to 1%. It's actually 1% now. You know, there were basically reserves shot through the roof for a lot of product lines, and this caused, you know, some of these failures that I was talking about. They happened around 1996, 1997, 1998 was related to this. But, you know, something needed to change, so the Ministry of Finance basically had to force their hand. So another thing that happened that was interesting, I thought I'd mention, is that in the during these regime change, for reserving, they basically introduced cash flow testing, which was alien up until that time. They had no concept of, you know, projecting cash flows and seeing what they looked like, what their balance sheet looked like, you know, 5, 10 years out. They just didn't do that in the insurance industry, even though they did it in other industries. So it was interesting. So another, you know, just some other points about what happened in the insurance industry around this time is now, obviously, ALM becomes important, right? So one of the first orders of business was increasing mass saturation, because they were really, really out of whack before that. And then with that came a switch to fixed income, longer term fixed income, especially Japanese government bonds. And then things like capital modeling and stress testing and internal models, things like that became, started to catch up with everywhere else. So, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about market trends since then that they've kind of had to go through to deal with this extended period of low interest rates. And one of those was a switch to shorter term products. And chief among those is these third sector products that I was telling you about. There's been a real growth in the late 90s of these medical type products. And so along with that is a switch to mortality and morbidity margins. Again, there's been a real growth in that type of market. So there was also growth in variable annuities. Well, at least in 2000, up until about 2008. And, so I'm just going to get rid of that one because it's no longer relevant. Variable annuities, basically, the market was decimated in Japan after 2008. So I think three of the four main players just withdrew entirely, or at least something like that. So, in their place now, and this was just getting popular as I left in 2011, were these kind of foreign fixed income index products, which were basically wealth management products where, and there were different types. Maybe the company was taking the foreign exchange risk, or maybe the policyholder was taking the foreign exchange risk. But these were as a way to find yield. These started to become popular, and they maybe have grown. I haven't really seen in the last 2 years, but I think they've probably grown in popularity since then. So one of the last trends that you see in Japan these days, and this is basically Japanese domestic life insurance companies trying to expand globally, and not specifically within the Asia Pacific region. And the reasons, there are many reasons for it. Obviously, there's a very tough environment in Japan. There's a tough regulatory environment. There's a tough investment environment. These companies tend to be really cash rich, so they have a lot of cash, and they have nowhere to put it. So these Nippon Life, Daiichi Life, Tokio Marine, they're very, very active in trying to acquire companies or start joint ventures in places like Malaysia or China or India or a number of countries. So this has been a trend that was very good for consulting companies because there's a lot of M&A work if you're working in that industry. Okay, so I wanted to talk just a little bit about my experiences working in Japan. Being a Canadian and showing up in a Japanese company, like the places I work, basically everybody was Japanese. There are very, very few to no foreigners. And, I speak the language, but I'm not ultra fluent. So you can imagine I had a number of missteps and all kinds of crazy adventures, trying to navigate working, in a Japanese company. And they have a very unique culture and they have unique ways of communicating, things like that, which brings me to my next quiz. So, what is the meaning of the word sumimasen? Sumimasen. And don't think that the robot is implying the meaning by doing this. It's not. It's just a picture. So, excuse me. Thank you. Excuse me. A is excuse me. B is yes, please. C is I'm sorry. And D is, what's that one? Thank you. Okay, so, who thinks it's A? Excuse me. Okay, who thinks it's B? Got some B's. Who thinks it's C? Who thinks it's D? Okay, so most people chose C. Well, this is a trick question. All of the above. It means all of them, and there are actually, I think, three or four other meanings that I couldn't fit on the slide. So, this is the kind of dilemma that I faced as a Canadian, learning Japanese, limited Japanese, working in a Japanese, cultural environment, the work environment. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the some unique aspects of the culture there. And so the first really is the communication barriers that I faced while I was there. In particular, actually, on these slides, I think I'm going to sort of go out of order here, but for me, because I spoke Japanese, it wasn't the language that was my problem so much, it's the style of communication, right? So there's a big cultural, communicational difference between Canadians and Japanese, which is called contextual communication. So what that means, you could be either a high context communicator, or you can be a low context communicator. And a low context communicator is someone who, you know, if they speak with someone else, they assume that there's no shared understanding, there's no shared knowledge. So I basically, if I'm a low context communicator, I have to explain everything to you because I don't assume that you have a shared understanding of certain things. A high context communicator is someone who assumes that there is, you know, there's a shared understanding. Right? And that shared, you know, the higher that assumption is, the harder it is to communicate with someone like that, because they'll only end up actually verbally expressing to you maybe 50% of what they're actually thinking. And the other 50% is just understood. And so, as you can imagine, Japanese are high context communicators and Canadians are low context communicators. And, you know, and so I think I'm a pretty low context communicator because I talk a lot and I never shut up. So, I had difficulty with this because, and to give you an example, I was working on an M&A project with my boss, and you know, we were discussing what the deliverables would be, and I said, okay, I will build the model. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build the model. That's my deliverable. You can calculate, you know, the present value, future profits, or whatever, and this is it. So, and then he said, yes, that sounds great. That's what we'll do. You deliver the model. So my low context communication, you know, told me that, okay, I'm building the model. His high context communication told him that, okay, he's building the model, he's handling the billing, he's communicating with the client, he's doing the project management, right? So, yeah, so I 2 weeks in, he's like, well, have you organized any meetings with the client? Have you, sent out any bills? I'm like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I don't know. And that's with the benefit of speaking the language. If you don't speak the language and you go to work there, it's just that much more difficult. So another interesting thing about the communication barriers, I work a lot for these multinational companies, and typically in a multinational company you have expats from the US or from Europe or whatever, and they're coming in as the CEO, chief agent, CFO, and then all of the minions are Japanese. So everybody beneath them are Japanese, and there's a huge communication wall between those two camps. Because they don't really train people coming in as expats to deal with the communication. So I used to work. I had one client who was a CFO of a multinational, and I'd have a meeting with him from 10 to 11, and then I'd have another meeting with his minions from 11 to 12, and then they would be telling me things and telling me to tell the other party, can you communicate this to them, right? And then oftentimes they'd be like, okay, well tell this, but don't tell that. And so I sit there, and this is a problem that's actually very pervasive in these multinationals, that the communication is not 100%. A lot of things are withheld on both sides. And, part of it is language barrier, part of it is, cultural understanding. But anyway, navigating this was, was amusing, to say the least. So, what's the next one? Decision by consensus. This is also interesting. If you work for a Japanese company, on top of the fact that they really like quality assurance, everything has to be approved by like 100 people. So, for these slides, for example, if I were to do this presentation in Japan, then my slides would have to be approved by, let's say, 9 people, and I would have to have finished it maybe 2 weeks ago, versus having finished it, at 4:30 p.m. today. So, it's good in that you get a lot of sets of eyes, but on the other hand, it's really hard to get things done quickly, make decisions quickly. It's a little bit inflexible, right? I talked about high context communication a little bit. What I wanted to talk about also was harmony, which I don't have on this list, but it's occurring to me that I like to speak about it. Harmony in the Japanese workplace is very, very important. More than anything else, you do not want to rock the boat, ever. You don't rock the boat. And that's really good in a way, because What that means is you never chew someone out in front of your coworkers. You don't blame people. People don't yell at each other. And they have this mentality that, well, if this person failed at their job, it wasn't this person, it was all of us. We all fail together or we all succeed together. That's kind of the way that they think. And, you know, that's because they don't like singling each other out. They don't like confrontation or anything like that. And I really appreciated that aspect because who knows how many times I screwed up. So, well, you know, you don't understand things, right? So, but on the other hand, he brings up some other interesting communication, you know, pitfalls. So one of the best ones, I think, is that Japanese people will never tell you no directly. They don't say no. Or if you ask them something, if you say, well, I think this, you know, we should take this project A, let's do project A. Let's go with that. And they will never say no. Even if they think it's the worst idea in the world, they'll never tell you no. They have ways of saying yes that imply no. But you have to know. This is the thing. If you don't know, then you know, you think, oh yeah, let's go ahead, great. Oh, you know, I'll get the budget ready and everything. So, you know, a good one is if you say, okay, what do you think about Project A? Let's go ahead with Project A. Instead of saying no, they'll be like, I understand. I see. What's that mean? I mean, it's non-committal at best. It's not clearly not a no, but. So, but if you don't, that's actually means, yeah, nice idea, but no chance now. That's basically what that means, right? If you say, another way to say no in Japanese is to kind of say, well, I think, and then trail off, right? And not say anything. So, what do you think about this idea? Well, I think, and then just walk away. That's an assertive no. The other one was a polite no, then there's the assertive no, then there's the aggressive no. And the aggressive no is, you know, well, what do you think about Project A? And they're like, step back, suck in the teeth. Like, that's, I think most people get that one, so. That's, you know, you've had a really bad idea right there, if you get that. So, there's that one. Another interesting aspect, work culture in Japan, is relationship building in general, I think. Relationships are very, very important in Japanese business. I think relationships are very important. In Asia in general, work is done through relationships. You know, there's a lot of value placed on relationships. In Japan, in the workplace, it manifests itself in interesting ways. The way that relationships work in the workplace is similar to how relationships work at the keiretsu level. I mean, these are all aspects of the same thing. But if you work in a Japanese company, during the day, you don't have much opportunity to, you know, build relationships with people. So people are stoic, they're kind of nosed down in their work, and they're working really hard, and you know, the days are long, and they have lots to do, and they don't typically try and build relationships with each other. So the relationship building, because it's important, has to take place after work. And that involves lots and lots of alcohol, basically. And this is very similar throughout Asia. It's not unique to Japan. But if you're the outsider, you know, who, you know, you got to learn the rules. There are rules to this type of stuff. So, for example, if your boss decides, okay, we're going to go out drinking tonight to build relationships, you're basically obligated to go. You and all of your coworkers, everyone who works for that person, is basically going drinking and then going to sing karaoke afterwards. That's what's going to happen, right? And, you know, I mean, it's fun, but it's a little different. And another interesting thing, you could get as drunk as you want to, you know, whatever, you can pass out, whatever happens, happens, and the next day, nobody talks about it. It's never mentioned again, like it never happened. Even if you and your boss punched the heck out of each other, who knows what you did, you went through a plate glass window, nobody talks about it. Water under the bridge. So, you can imagine, you know, arriving there for the first time, and the first time I showed up, I went to a welcome party. And I thought, oh, this would be nice, you know, I'll have a little dinner. And we had dinner, and then we went to a bar, then we went to another bar, then we went to sing karaoke, then another bar. I'm like, I just got here, you know? So the last thing I wanted to talk about on this list is the group dynamic. I think people know about this, you know, well enough in Japan. People are very, very group-minded. From the work context, though, the interesting thing is how you introduce yourself is interesting. So in Japan, the group, they teach you from a very, very young age that the group is, the collective is more important than the individual, right? So If I introduce myself, I put my family name before my own name, because the group I belong to, my family, is more important than the individual myself, right? If I introduce myself in a work setting, then the group that supersedes everything is actually my company. So if I introduce myself, I would be Deloitte Roderick Warren. That's how I would introduce myself. The company name comes first, my family name comes second, and you know, my individual name comes last. And you know, so that's it's interesting. It's very indicative of the way of thinking in Japan in general. And you can see these things are all, you know, all related. I think decisions by consensus, for example, you know, the harmony that I talked about, all of these kinds of things are all about, you know, very group-mindedness, which I guess, you know, when you live in this culture that's been exposed to natural disasters for centuries, you know, that's how you survive it, is by, you know, having this group-mindedness. You're not going to survive this massive earthquake on your own. You know, the only way you're going to survive it is if you, you know, kind of stick together. So you can see, I mean, these things have sort of made their way into the cultural fabric of Japan. So, you know, it's interesting, even at the work level, I find it interesting. So, anyway, I guess that's the end of my presentation. So I, you know, if there's questions, I don't know, I'm not sure, but I don't know how long I took there. I hope it wasn't too long or too short. But, yeah.